Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage urologist, Dr. Bill Clark. Our topic today is prostate disease. We're going to try to focus a bulk of the program on prostate cancer for those of you who have questions or comments. But please feel free to call about other prostate-related issues if you would like. You can reach us with your questions and comments in Anchorage. Our toll-free or our regular number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Bill, it's wonderful to have you back. I think you've done this three or four times now.
Yeah, it's great to be back, and thank you again for the invitation.
Sure. We're kind of introducing the idea of prostate cancer and a prostate screening that's going to be going on for most of the second half of the month of September, both at Alaska Regional, then at Providence, and then there's one out at the Valley. We'll keep giving you some heads up on those dates and times for those who are listening, so get a pencil and a piece of paper. Also, you can go to ksk.org, line1@alaskapublic.org, and get some specific information if you can't get this written down. And remember, you can always go to that website if you don't get the information you need during the time the program is on. Dr. Clark is a urologist. He's been practicing in Anchorage since about 1989. He started at Alaska Urological Institute, whose office is over on Alaska Regional campus. Bill, what's important for us to talk about today? What's turning you on about prostate cancers now?
Well, I think my biggest interest is turned to more advanced prostate disease and treatment, and trying to differentiate who's really going to get to the advanced disease. I think that's what's the most exciting thing going on right now, and actually having some new options for treatment of those folks after essentially 100 years of not having much change in how we treated prostate cancer, to finally be able to identify some options that certainly weren't available in some really new, exciting areas.
Okay. So we'll get to that treatment and especially more advanced disease and some of the options regarding screening and treatment. Before we do that, let's talk about prostate cancer in general. Who's at risk is usually a first kind of question. Besides being males, is it something that's more in the elderly or at different age groups at greater risk?
Well, I think it can be in a much wider group of men than I think is generally appreciated. Certainly can occur. My youngest patient is age 31, which is certainly much younger than most people would initially think about. But I think one of the things, just to talk about basically what the prostate is in general, and the prostate is a gland that sits at the base of the bladder, and in a general sense, it's sort of a donut that surrounds the base of the bladder, and you void through the center of that donut. Mm-hmm. And so problems that would give you any kind of obstruction, enlargement in that area, will give you problems with voiding. And it can be voiding too much, too little, kind of a change from any what is basically a normal pattern for that individual would kind of tip you off that you have some issues going on. And those issues aren't necessarily cancer. They could be anything from just benign enlargement to bladder stones to infections to trauma. And certainly one of the toughest issues is cancer.
Mm-hmm. What would be – is there a specific symptom that would lead you to think about, and our listeners to think about, the more likely the possibility of cancer versus some of the more less worrisome kinds of problems?
Well, unfortunately, there's not. And that's one of the toughest things about prostate cancer, is it's basically so silent in so many folks.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons before I started, we didn't actually have anything to monitor this. And PSA coming about was a revolution for us, because well over 50 to, depending on, especially in the black population, 90% of the cancers we picked up when I started in the mid-80s were already metastatic, meaning that it was already in the bones, that they came in coughing up blood from tumor in their chest, fracturing a hip or a femur. And at that point, it was a very difficult situation to deal with. So being able to pick up those folks earlier has totally changed the landscape for prostate cancer.
So what you're saying is, in the past, the disease did not give many very telltale symptoms that were specific until it was very, very late, much like we may think about bowel cancer, although that's changing also. And one of the reasons for this earlier recognition is not symptoms, but a test you said called PSA, which stands for, and what does it tell us?
It stands for prostate-specific antigen.
Okay.
And it's an antigen or a protein that is basically created in only prostate cells or prostate cancer cells. That's why it's actually quite an efficient way to monitor. It was originally actually set up to, and the real revolution with finding this was, you could now follow a patient with prostate cancer after they had a radical prostatectomy or complete removal of the prostate to see whether they had a recurrent disease. Because the only thing that made PSA was a normal cell or a prostate cancer cell. Mm-hmm. If all the normal cells were removed, the only thing that would give you a PSA would be a prostate cancer cell, and therefore you could find an earlier recurrence and get on to other treatments. Mm-hmm. We've kind of tried to make, to some extent, a round peg fit in a square hole by trying to make it go on to be a screening device. And therefore, we've kind of created some real issues in how to do that and how efficient it is. And I think that's been the real controversy with regard to PSA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when you talk about a screening test, I think it's important for the public to understand a screening test is basically a test that says above a certain line in the sand, statistically, some disease or problem is more related. It doesn't mean it's there if it's higher. It just increases the likelihood, and vice versa. If it's lower, it doesn't mean that it isn't there. You just have to put a line there, and you always put the line on the safest place. So there's a tendency for screening tests to over-refer. We don't want to miss one that's there. We'll take the risk of over-diagnosing. And so there's no perfect test. And that's a general thing I think it helps the public to understand about screening tests. So the prostate-specific antigen is made by everybody's prostate. Every male's got one. And so there was a line drawn and said over this area, it indicates some kind of pathology.
Well, actually, it's unfortunately a little bit more complicated than that as well.
Okay.
Because partially what we got in trouble with as far as designing a screening test. What is that number?
Right.
And
right.
it's just bounced around from originally it's 4, then went to 1.5, then 2.5, then it went to age differentiation. Uh-huh. Then we looked at PSA density, the size of the prostate, and
how fast it was changing.
Yeah. How fast it's changing still appears to be the most reliable way.
Okay.
Although we're working on better options as well.
Uh-huh. And so just for people to understand, as you're trying to figure out a screening test, it may take several attempts at large studies to really come up with the best. It's not perfect. There is not a perfect one. But after several trials, it looks like the rate of which this number goes up may be the better indicator of the potential for a cancer. Is that what you're saying now?
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons why we're so excited about the annual prostate cancer screening, mm-hmm. to be able to, and I say the most important thing for patients to come away with that is not so much what the number is this year is what it was compared to last year.
Right.
And if you don't have last year's, you can't compare that.
Yeah. I know I'm keeping mine. I've been doing this for 10 years. Mine are all written down, and they'll oscillate a little bit for various reasons. But it's the trend that really probably helps more than anything. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think that's for sure what we look at right now.
Let me remind listeners again, we're talking about prostate cancer and other prostate problems if you have such questions or comments, but primarily prostate cancer, if you don't mind, with Dr. Bill Clark. You can reach us at 550-8433 during the next hour or so, 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is lineone@alaskapublic.org. Are there individuals that seem to be at greater risk? You mentioned that a black population seemed to have very bad disease when it was discovered prior to the use of a PSA. Is that a high-risk group?
It is. They have a higher incidence, and they seem to have also a more aggressive disease once it is discovered, unfortunately. Kind of a lower risk actually seem to be Asians. And there are certainly some pretty aggressive studies epidemiologically trying to figure out why that should be, whether it's genetic versus other kind of dietary lifestyle changes. Right. And it's difficult to sort that out. But the reality is that's where we are right now. Mm-hmm. Actually, the highest incidence in the world is the comes from the Northern European, the Finnish folks. Mm-hmm. Have the overall highest, and that's why some of the population studies being done in Scandinavia are actually quite revealing as far as what's going on.
Are there thoughts about triggers or etiology? Is it primarily genetic, primarily environmental, or like so many things, combination of both?
Well, I think we're going to find it's a combination of both, but some of the more exciting things is now it appears that there are some potential viral etiologies. Mm-hmm. So much as we've seen in cervical cancer, there are some slow viruses that may actually be a significant factor and would be a target to be able to prevent some of these as well, which is, I think, pretty exciting news.
Mm-hmm. I think Bill's alluding to the fact that a very high percentage of cervical cancers have been related to human papillomavirus, which is two strains in particular, which are related, which are basically wart viruses. But these particular viruses do have some ability to cause cancer, perhaps in certain susceptible individuals. So that the same thing may be playing itself out in prostate cancer. And if that's the case, then perhaps, like with cervical cancer, vaccines may become very preventative. It's been a big advance in cervical cancer, is my understanding.
Absolutely.
We have a caller, Dr. Clark. Let's take Mark. Mark, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I was wondering the effects of prostatitis on prostate cancer. I've had chronic prostatitis for about 8 years. I get a couple of bouts every year. I have to take the round of antibiotics. I wonder if that makes it, if I have a higher likelihood, or okay, if anybody in general would have a higher likelihood in getting prostate cancer.
Yeah, great question. Let me ask Dr. Clark to comment on what is prostatitis, particularly what is chronic prostatitis, before we get into whether it's a triggering or a risk factor for cancer.
Well, yeah, chronic prostatitis is a very troublesome issue for patients and for physicians alike. Unfortunately, we're still in the works trying to figure out what that really is caused from and the best treatments for it. Certainly the classic thing is a bacterial infection, which causes swelling and lots of symptoms and bleeding and fevers and such. There's a number of issues where other causes may be the case. Certainly some potential viral problems. There's anti-inflammatory medications that work, meaning that maybe there's some other aspects of this swelling that would occur and certainly irritate it. Activities can certainly do it too, the trauma, the Marlboro horseback rider kind of patients certainly can
have more trouble.
Can have more trouble, no question. Whether or not the classic answer as to whether this sets you up for being able to go on to develop prostate cancer, the answer has always been no. There's some issues about some of the inflammatory processes that what we call pro-inflammatory factors that may actually be a little higher likelihood. And the real difficulty is, number one, we don't know. But the second is that because PSA has been one of the things we utilize to try to determine who does and who doesn't have it, PSA and prostatitis or any of the chronic pelvic pain syndromes, which are kind of related to that, have PSAs that just jump all over the place. And that makes it difficult to be able to screen. And so one of the thoughts is maybe we catch it too late in those patients. And so it so may be a problem or may not be a problem. And so it's really a difficult management issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you follow that, Mark?
Absolutely. That's kind of what I got from my VA doctor is that, we think this is a complex thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of where we are, I think, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately, what Dr. Clark was saying is that with prostatitis, your PSA goes up. So it's harder to be sure, and maybe we're hanging in there too long without getting more aggressive and looking. So it may, for that reason, appear that cancer is more common or less common. So it clouds the issue, and it's difficult. You know, it's almost intuitive to think that a chronic inflammatory state would lead to more cancer. But and so I would have answered that, yeah, probably, but that's not what the evidence shows. Is that right, Dr. Clark?
That's true.
Yeah.
We haven't been able to have a study in those patients, which actually demonstrates that, but that's certainly still a big concern. Yeah. So
what's Mark need to do? How does he approach his concerns about is he developing prostate cancer?
I think the biggest thing is what is really the case with all the folks in the whether it's a family history or whether you're racially more predisposed is basically keeping a close eye on things and really developing a high suspicion or index of suspicion, we call it, and keeping an eye on things. And we try not to be more aggressive than we have to. It used to be that we did a lot more biopsies than we probably need to do it. And there are some new things coming out. There's some urine-based biopsies, which are pretty exciting. The PCA3 is the one that's been actually FDA approved now. There are a couple more that actually are in the works, and I think within the next 2 years will be available. And there's some new data looking at some of the hereditary patterns, and it appears to be from the Scandinavian studies in conjunction. There's a very large family history project with the Scandinavian folks and the folks from Johns Hopkins, which have identified a 5-gene sequence, which appears to be the hereditary or sort of family history prostate cancer group. Mm-hmm. So being able to have that available, I think, is going to be very helpful.
All right. So, Mark, do you mind if we ask how you're going about watching for the possibility of prostate cancer?
Sure. Well, anytime I have a bout, if you will, I contact the VA and we attack it with antibiotics. But for my annual appointment, they do the PSA test. Mm-hmm. Annually, and that's usually, February, March timeframe every year within a couple months. Mm-hmm. And so far, if things come back normal, I don't know that there is anything else I can do to be more proactive than that. If there is, I'd love to know.
Actually, I think the evidence that's coming out is that there probably are some more things you can do, which is one of my favorite urologists, Dr. Mark Moyet, has come out with the mantra that what's good for your heart's good for your prostate. And actually, it turns out some studies looking at increasing exercise, keeping your cholesterol down, things that are endothelial or blood vessel related kind of parameters will actually be helpful for prostate and prostatitis as well. So getting more exercise, keeping your weight down, making sure if you have diabetes that that's under the best control you can. And those are all things that actually are sort of lifestyle, dietary kind of changes. So I think keeping those things under as good a control as you can.
What about, my understanding is when you have the prostatitis, your PSA goes up, but then with treatment, it comes back down. I was wondering is if you did a serial testing, could you establish a reasonable baseline on somebody with chronic prostatitis with which to make your decisions instead of those big flare-ups?
And actually, that's what we try to do is we try not to draw PSAs during times when you have those inflammatory flares because what happens is it just skews the numbers dramatically.
Right. And Mark, it sounds to me also that there may be on the horizon some tests, one of which Dr. Clark mentioned to me before we came on the air, where there's some – he mentioned the urine testing, and there may be some other ways to get some ideas without being too invasive about monitoring for cells that may be cancerous in the bloodstream and looking at urine cell – urine under a microscope very carefully for the presence of some malignant cells. So you I think what I would say, unless Mark – or unless Dr. Clark tells me otherwise, is you want to keep asking about new things to monitor yourself as you proceed, because you're a little bit more difficult to read for that early onset.
I will definitely do that, and I appreciate the information.
Yeah, you bet. Good luck.
Okay, thank you.
We talked about, let's see, risk factors and symptoms. We kind of went over. I know with benign prostatic hypertrophy, men will start having trouble urinating, initiating a stream, dribbling, getting up a lot at night. Would they perhaps even have blood or a change in the color of the urine with those things? So really what you're saying is there's none of those symptomatically are very helpful. We're stuck with some objective testing. And the PSA, I'm assuming you're going to tell us, even better than a prostate exam, although those are still done.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that those are all symptoms that I think should be looked into when you have those. But as far as differentiating what the real cause is, that's kind of the dilemma.
Yeah.
But those are all certainly things that I think if you have those, and especially urgency kind of things as well, is another.
Urgency means you've got to go and you got to go now.
Can't wait.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. And then you said family history is important, particularly it looks like in the Finnish there may be a genetic predisposition to why they're having so much a problem up there. It's been worked on. So we get a PSA that's a little bit higher than what we'd like to see. What's the next course for most people? I know we're increasingly being aware of the importance of individualizing these steps based on age. A 40-year-old may be different than a 90-year-old, for example. But in general, what would be the next step?
Well, the classic next step with a questionable PSA would go on to do what's called a transrectal ultrasound and biopsy, where a small needle core segment is taken just under local analgesia in the office. And the most important thing with that is to make sure you have good antibiotic coverage, because it is a certainly high risk for a bacterial infection initiated with the biopsy, although it's well controlled with the antibiotic suppression. And from that point, determining the type of cancer, which basically really relates to what we call the aggressiveness of the disease, and we use a Gleason scale, is pretty much the most accepted one now, which goes from 2 to 10, with 2 being sort of a barely cancer, and 10 being the most aggressive phase. There's also kind of some controversial issues about sort of a precancerous state, which we called high-grade PIN or prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia. But that is still fairly controversial status, but certainly one where you want to follow more closely.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have a diagnosis of cancer, started with if you don't have the prostate cancer diagnosis, then certainly keeping a close eye on screening. There's some interesting data looking at prostate cancer suppression I hate to say prevention, but actually, because the FDA kind of went back and forth about that in this last December and decided that they didn't want to give that indication to the true drugs, which actually have some data that would support that. But Proscar and Avodart are two drugs which did have anywhere from 25% to 30% suppression of prostate cancer in those individuals taking it.
And they're taking it for benign prostatic hypertrophy. And it improves those symptoms, but while they were on that, they had less cancer occur. And so the argument is, is that due to that, or is it have? Is there some other? Is it due to the medication, or is that why they say it's not preventative?
The issue became, and the way that the panel made their decision on that was because there was a between 3% and 6% increase in what they called high-grade cancers when you found it. So the thought was, if you got a cancer, it was a higher-grade cancer, and weighing the likelihood of the 3% to 5% or 6% increase in high-grade versus the 25% reduction in overall cancer, what was the trade-off? And they decided against that, which I think, just
because you're on a treatment of any sort at the time doesn't necessarily mean that caused the higher grade, or it doesn't necessarily mean it caused less cancer to develop. You take some more thorough work to really case that. It's difficult sometimes, but it's encouraging to see that kind of finding.
Absolutely. And some of us were much more encouraged than the FDA was. One of the problems with the FDA was they actually, this is one of the first times they said there was an economic issue with this, even though they showed there was a decrease if the cost to society for putting more people on it that would be necessary was a real issue. And I kind of have some thoughts about whether they need to be making those decisions or not, but that's how they decided.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners again, as you're listening to Line One, your Health Connection, if you've got questions or comments about prostate disease, but particularly prostate cancer, our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. What is, before we take our break today, what is the natural history of the typical prostate cancer? I think it's always important to get back to what's the typical way this disease, this problem proceeds without treatment, not to say that everybody's does that, but most typically.
Well, that's actually been one of the tough issues, is that we don't really for sure have a typical pattern. I think to start with, you can differentiate, and the one thing we have seen is patients that come up with a grade 8, 9, or 10 prostate cancer definitely have aggressive disease and are way higher risk for developing something within probably the next 3 years, which could be, a fatal event if untreated. And people in the under, up to 7, is kind of the real controversial group. Most everybody would, in an 8, 9, or 10, say you need to proceed with some sort of treatment, because that the odds are just way too high that that's going to be a problem. The other individuals are in that group where there's a move to try to determine that aggressiveness factor. And the Europeans have been much more looking at surveillance protocols, which the Americans were kind of down on previously. But their data actually looks not unreasonable at all for proceeding with kind of a wait-and-see kind of protocol.
All right, we're going to take a short break here, and then I want to get back to this issue of aggressiveness versus non-aggressive. And then we have a couple of phone calls that I want to take. I want to remind listeners again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll continue to answer any phone calls or emails on prostate problems with Dr. Bill Clark. You're listening to Line One, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line One, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line One, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Bill Clark, an Anchorage urologist. We've been talking about prostate cancer primarily, but he is interested in fielding questions about prostate disease. If you have any, you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can give us a call at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8, it's a recorded rebroadcast, and we won't be able to answer your questions. Before I move on, I want to mention that, and this is where you need your pencil and a piece of paper, there are several free annual prostate screening events going on at Alaska Medical Plaza. It's going to be September 19th, 20th. 22, 23, and 24 at various times. You can go to alaskapublic.org, our Line 1 address, to get the specifics, but the phone number is 276-1474. And then from September 26th to 29th, it's going to be at the Providence Hospital. That phone number is 212-6870. And then on September 30th, which is a Friday, from 11 to 6, it's going to be out at the Valley Hospital, 745-9300. I'll try to give those dates again and some contact numbers. But if you go to line1@alaskapublic.org, we'll have that information available for you at any time. Just before we get back to some questions that have come in on his phone calls, Bill, it seems to me that this issue of aggressiveness really muddies the water. If we are not able to tell who's going to be having aggressive disease, and that means going ahead and have metastasis and is much more likely to have significant morbidity or die of this disease than others in which it's a much more indolent, maybe not even a life-threatening illness. This PSA has some limitations for that reason. Is that true, and how are we circumventing that issue?
Well, that is the real dilemma of this whole, I think, issue of prostate cancer and trying to differentiate those folks right now that the Europeans trials are using a protocol where they look at what we call the PSA doubling time, how fast the PSA is changing. Mm-hmm. And there does seem to be sort of a critical mass of tumor that seems to sort of explode at a certain point. And that trying to determine that is sort of a very troublesome issue. The PSA doubling time of 6 to 9 months actually appears to be a much more aggressive time period than that, probably within, again, 2 to 3 years is going to change its stage, meaning it's becoming metastatic, at least by the European trials. Unfortunately, some of the trials that have been initiated over here have not as much time frame to look at because prostate cancer is a slower disease, and you need statistically probably a minimum of 7 years follow-up on these patients to be able to differentiate a real distinction between each of these treatment arms because there's so many other factors that can go into it. But I think the PSA doubling time is still one of the best things. The American trials are a little bit more into using some repeat biopsies to be able to differentiate it as well. The good and bad about having our biopsies done with such a small needle now and getting such a small sample is much more minimally invasive. The problem is you could be missing parts of the tumor which are more aggressive, and maybe we are understaging, mm-hmm. if, so to speak, these tumors that still may be aggressive. Yeah. I think one of the other things to look at is actually I feel pretty strongly about is looking at the age of the patient. What's the kind of hard and hardcore facts if you're an actuary looking at the life insurance, you know, who's going to pay for your life or death. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the number of years you have at risk for this, if you're a 40-year-old and have any prostate cancer, that's not good, as opposed to being 80 years old. And I think looking at life expectancy is a very objective way to at least kind of start the discussion as well.
For individual decisions.
Exactly.
Yeah. Does the Gleason score correlate well with aggressiveness?
Certainly the higher grades do.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question.
Okay.
And I think that that actually, there's very little doubt or the Europeans, no question, would treat an 8, 9, or 10. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless the patient has less than a 2-year survival rate anyway.
Okay. And the Gleason score requires a biopsy, so
yeah. Right now, that's the case.
Okay. All right, we got a couple of callers. Charles, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I was just kind of curious. If you were taking medication, say, for like overactive bladder or like an enlarged prostate, would that potentially put you at a higher risk of not noticing onset of prostate cancer symptoms?
Oh, that's a very good question. There's two that where that does muddy the water significantly, although it may actually be an advantage depending on what we kind of are using it for. The patients primarily that are using the two what are called 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, which is Proscar or finasteride, as it's now generically called, and Avodart, are the two that will do this. And there's a very interesting protocol that says if your PSA doesn't drop by 50% of your baseline value within 6 to 9 months, then you're likely to have having prostate cancer, and potentially a more aggressive prostate cancer is higher. So maybe that's something that some people would say is somewhat diagnostic. There does appear to be a new baseline that's established when patients are on these meds, and so therefore you do need to follow the PSA more closely, because when it does change from that baseline on those medications, the likelihood of having cancer is actually significantly higher than it would be not being on that medication to start with. So there's a yes and no kind of answer there.
Okay, so would you suggest if you were on a medication of that nature, you should, even if you were under the age of, you know, the atypical danger zone, should you be more readily tested?
I think you need to establish a new baseline. That's absolutely okay. True.
Okay, thank you. That was all I had.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thanks for your call. John, you're on line one.
Yes, hello. Afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I have prostate cancer and bladder cancer at the same time. Well, I had it in my bladder and it migrated to my prostate. So they took them both. They tried to nip it out of my bladder, and then it went. In 6 months, it migrated to my prostate. They didn't get it all. Anyway, they took my prostate, and I was just. My main concern is since they did that. I seem to have lost a lot of my enthusiasm. You know, I mean, I've got kind of like the blahs, and I've heard about testosterone. Is there a symptom associated with losing your prostate where you lose a little bit of your in you know your enthusiasm, your get up and go?
There's not necessarily a cause and effect, but certainly. There is getting to be more data that a low testosterone does put people at higher risk for prostate disease and more specifically prostate cancer. So I think the...
No, I mean, they already took my prostate out.
Right. So theoretically, you might be more likely to have a low... What I'm getting to is the more likely scenario is you might have a low testosterone, which... is certainly a reasonable thing to check for. And if that were the case, that would be potentially one treatment option. Although people on prostate cancer, generally, we don't like to have on something that might be a prostate cancer promoter. So, but certainly drawing that level would be a very reasonable thing to do to be able to tell you whether that is an issue or not.
John, let me see if I can clarify this, because I think it's important for other listeners as well. First off, your prostate is not the source of testosterone. Is that true, Bill?
That's true.
It's coming from your testicles. And you know, with age, your testosterone may drop. That's important to understand.
Well, I'm 65.
Yep. I understand. And three, high testosterone may drive some of these cancers. And in fact, a lot of treatments are involved with blocking testosterone now. So you want to approach this issue carefully with with a history of prostate cancer. I'm not sure the same is true with bladder cancer, but for prostate cancer. Is that right, Bill?
Right. But but I think objectively, it's, you know, it is a hormone, and, yep, and to know where you are, you got to draw a level.
Yeah, it's easy to, you just draw a level. That's true.
So if you lose your prostate, you're not necessarily losing your testosterone.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not.
Okay.
Yeah, and there is a lot of variation there. There's a lot of money being made selling men testosterone who have pretty normal testosterone levels, incidentally.
Okay. Well, only one other thing I would like to say is that people should realize, I haven't heard you gentlemen mention it yet, but there is no pain associated with this. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I had a cancer growth of the size of a lemon, and I felt no pain. If I wouldn't have passed blood, I would have never known that I had anything.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And it's back to something Bill had said earlier. There is no good symptom relation. This is one of those things where you have to have some testing done to be sure. And that's the primary reason the message should be getting out to men over 40, I think, is what's often said. You need to start thinking about getting an annual test and get some baseline on how their prostate feels and what their PSA is. Is the way to start monitoring for this disease.
Well, you gentlemen mentioned that urine testing. I had that after my first laparoscopic on my bladder. For 6 months, I had that test done periodically. And after my third test, I passed blood again, and they had to go in. So it never showed. They said from the results of those tests that I was in recession. But yet, it 3 weeks after my last test, I was passing blood again. And I had to go back in, and that's when I took the bladder and the prostate out. So anyway, so it's real important. If you pass blood, I mean, people were telling me that, you passed the kidney stone, don't worry about it, you know.
Right.
Don't take anybody's word for it. You need to go get tested.
Right, right.
Thanks for your comments.
Well, thank you very much. That's all I had to that's all I had to know. Thank you.
All right, well, good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me remind everybody again about the prostate screening. I'm going to give you this information once more, but I also want to remind you, if you go to line one at alaskapublic.org, it will be online. You can see it at any time. But there's free screening September 19th, basically through the 24th, with an exception of one day at Alaska Regional. That contact number is 276-1474. That's Alaska Regional on the 19th through the 24th, 276-1474. Providence, September 26th through the 29th, 212-6870. September 26th to the 29th, 212-6870 at Providence, and in the Valley on September 30th, most of the day that day, September 30th, 745-9300 is the phone number to call for more information on that. And before I forget, I have one more little announcement. We'll get back to the prostate. And that is the healthcare system in Alaska and across the United States is changing rapidly to an electronic-based medical records and much more interconnectivity. And there is constant training going on, a new training that's going to be available to healthcare providers about health information technology and answering all your questions, so to speak. And getting this started will be September 28th. At the Millennium Hotel, September 28th. It's an all-day program. The contact phone number for that is 1-800-478-6653. That number will also be on our website, line1 at alaskapublic.org. 1-800-478-6653, and then really it's extension 9469 for a Health Information Technology course for professionals, September 28th, Millennium Hotel. All right. You started this program by talking about new developments in treatment. I've not let you talk about that. So tell us what we need to know about treatment.
Yes, I think that to me the most exciting thing is for essentially 100 years we've had very little change in how we've treated prostate cancer, and I think that's led to some of the real dilemma about treatment was the treatment worse than the disease. And I think in the last few years, the most exciting thing, especially for us that are kind of dealing in more advanced prostate cancer, the folks that have sort of gotten beyond the standard localized prostate cancer, which basically involve three different modalities. One is the addition of some new chemotherapy agents, which actually have been approved within the last year, which we never had previously. And the nice thing about those is they seem to be adding significant survival advantage, and as well reducing the side effects, some of the bone pain, some of the fractures from weak bones. And I think that's very exciting, some of the new taxanes. The second area, which was the first immune therapy, which has ever been approved in any kind of cancer, not prostate cancer, is called Provenge, and it was basically approved last May in a trial. Essentially, you can think of it as a vaccine, basically taking the patient's own blood, reprocessing it, giving it back to them, and actually initiating a tumor response, sort of like you'd think of in a typical vaccine. And it added essentially as much as we saw with the chemotherapy agents. The problem is that it's a very complicated and involved treatment, and very expensive as well. And I'm not sure, you know, in the big picture that that's going to be the exact modality that we'd want to use. But it certainly is a proof of concept, is what I feel. Mm-hmm. And there's some really much less aggressive and maybe much more effective options in that realm. A new vaccine, which we're hopefully be able to start in October of this year for patients. These are patients that have failed other therapies as well, which is the exciting thing, which we've never had any modalities for. The third is just this summer, a new receptor modulator. Essentially, it turns out that these tumors, we thought once they had escaped the hormone therapy, which basically, as we were talking about before, looking at testosterone therapy for these aggressive tumors, taking that away because they seem to feed on male hormone, treated these patients for sometimes extended periods of time. But once it failed, you basically formally thought that no other hormone treatment would be effective. And it turns out that these tumors are incredibly sneaky. They can actually take cholesterol, which is a building block of testosterone, and within the cell, basically transform that into their own food inside. So even though your testosterone level is measured essentially at zero in your bloodstream, the tumors are able to feed themselves and create their own food essentially. So now it looks like there are some very exciting markers, which are actually pill forms versus some of the other therapy, which were intravenous and somewhat more troublesome, are actually able to suppress that within the cells themselves and basically turn these tumors off. So I think those three areas are things that we sort of never would have, I think, thought before would be helpful.
Mm. Is the hormonal treatment something that is used, I guess, in the more typical thing? I'm thinking about the immunotherapy and the other therapy you mentioned. It's more of a when everything else fails, it seems like this one is you're treating somebody, they're responding by blocking a person, the man's own testosterone. Now they suddenly are having trouble again. You can go in, and one of the reasons may be that these cells have adapted to make their own testosterone. It seems like that's kind of ready for prime time. There seems
all these actually are FDA approved treatments. All three of them. That's the exciting thing. But going beyond that, at our research center, we've got sort of the next generation. These are all kind of early proof of concept, essentially. Again, they unfortunately, even though they're approved, add an average of 4.5 months survival time, which is, you know, is better. There's no question.
Yeah.
But that's certainly not what we're looking for. We're looking for something more than 4.5 months. So those new agents really take off on those concepts, and I think are looking much more impressive as far as a better response. And hopefully some of these would be able to be utilized much earlier, because these patients are all also patients that are sort of on the last legs and, you know, very difficult patients to deal with. Yeah. And so theoretically, the concept would be if you could start these much earlier, you could sort of cut these off at the pass and be much more effective, which being much more user-friendly as far as side effects as well.
You know, the ethics of this is very interesting and difficult. Is it true that, you know, the FDA and those physicians who are studying this do not want to give these newer treatments to some of these earlier patients because they're already going to do fairly well and you're risking some side effects? But so you wait till they're having more trouble when they're not going to be maybe as effective as they would be in the younger individuals. So you get into some real ethical issues that the patient really has to understand who might want to get into one of these studies to try to identify.
That's absolutely
clear. I mean, it's very difficult. And just because it fails late doesn't mean it may not be a very effective treatment early.
And the other thing we found that's actually very intriguing is we've always hung our hats so much on PSA that appears now that PSA may not be the best indicator of response in these tumors, that some of these other trials may have been shut off much too early. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly the case, it looks like, in some of the immune therapy where people's PSA will continue to rise for a while. We actually see sort of a tumor flare, and then all of a sudden it dies off very quickly. So a number of these studies were actually pushing well beyond, and they have to have more ways to measure this other than PSA.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is as you treat prostate cancer, then you suddenly may have a big increase in PSA because of the damage that you're doing to the prostate, and that may have been falsely understood as perhaps making things worse, when in fact it was good. And now we have to go back and relook at that information, those kinds of studies, based on what we now understand's going on.
Yep, that's
just
exactly
the way science moves. You got to be very careful, and it takes time, unfortunately. And often people don't want that. We start doing things too quick, and we end up with side effects and problems if you don't understand this process. Yeah, these are difficult issues, especially if you're sitting there dealing with prostate cancer right now. You want something to happen a little bit more quickly.
Absolutely, and that's sort of one of the problems as the research side and the doctor side you have with these individuals. And as a urologist, we deal with folks for years, and you get to know patients over sometimes 20 years plus time period. And so you have sort of this dilemma of pushing the research versus pushing the patient care. And so it's a very difficult position, but it's something that we need to absolutely do, because the only way to be more intelligent about how we do these is to get that data.
So what's the big message again today? The big message is we need to be proactive about looking for the possibility of prostate cancer.
Well, I think that's certainly one of them. The other is, I think, to not be quite as fatalistic about it. Mm-hmm. I think that there are new things that the thought that you're going to be disabled for life if this entity is found, and so therefore you don't want to do anything.
Right.
I think we're getting much less aggressive, some more focal therapies. There's some very interesting new laser therapies, high-intensity focused ultrasounds, things that might be able to do more of what we'd like to see is a sort of the breast cancer paradigm where you actually could do a lumpectomy and get on with some of these much less invasive or aggressive treatment plans and have much less of a consequence and therefore much less disability based on this new information.
So it's what I'm hearing is basically if you're over 40 or so, you need to start thinking about getting screened, get a baseline of where your prostate exam is and where your PSA is, and then keep talking to physicians that do this a lot, so they can give you all the different options, which are increasing, but that it is a treatable disease, and there's many more options available and less side effects to the treatments as we haven't talked about, but that seems to be generally
absolutely
the case, what you're implying with the treatments as well. So let me remind our listeners again, there's several prostate screenings going on, regional hospital, September 19th, 20th, 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. The contact number for making an appointment for that is 276 1474. I know I get told I can just walk in. You like to get people scheduled. You do. You guys do a great job of getting everybody that shows up screened. 276-1474, though, if you want to get a definite appointment. Providence, 212-6870. That's September 26th and 29th. And then finally on September 30th out in the valley at 745-9300. Last thoughts, Bill. We got a couple of minutes here.
Well, I think I just want to reiterate that the biggest problem when we started this prostate cancer screening, I think 17 years ago now, was that it always astounded me that for something free, then people complaining or having problems with the cost of medical care, it's hard to argue with a free exam anyway. And unless you, and the other thing I think is everybody should be able to take much more interest in their own health, and everybody should know their blood pressure, they should know their cholesterol, and they probably ought to know their PSA if they're guys.
One of the things that's really coming out more in medicine, I'm afraid, is that we are having to lean more on objective bits of information. The history is important, physical is important, but boy, sometimes you just need those numbers. I was always taught, you know, you listen to people and so forth, but we get led astray by not paying attention to our symptoms or not recognizing our symptoms. So this objective bit of information is very, very useful. So at these exam, at these screens, you have a prostate exam, you have some blood drawn, you get notified of that level. And then occasionally I've been asked to have another bit of blood taken for some of these other studies that you are ongoing to see if we can identify or find other ways to be more specific about aggressive cancers or making a new technique for diagnosing cancer. Is that what happens?
Yep, that's exactly right. And the more we learn, the better off we're going to be, I think.
All right. Well, we encourage everyone to go to our website and get that information about how to get the screening started. I want to thank Bill Clark for doing this a number of times over the years. It's been very helpful to me and I hope to our listeners. Thanks again, Bill.
Oh, thank you all very much.
Next week, we're going to be back. There'll be September 19th at 2 p.m. for the next edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guests at that time will be two individuals, Bill Sorrells, who's executive director of the Alaska eHealth Network, and Dr. Jerome List, who is with the Alaska eHealth Record Alliance. We're going to be talking about electronic medical records and more electronic interconnectivity between physicians, not only in Alaska, but throughout the country. There's good and bad about everything, and we'll try to bring all that up. Overall, I think most of us are feeling that this is going to be beneficial to patients, add some safety and some more better ways to communicate information to our patients. So I think it's a useful thing for all of us to hear about, not just those of us who are facing how to get this implemented. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack once again helped us as our audio engineer, and she's also our excellent web editor. Thanks for listening, especially to those of you who called and emailed. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.